And welcoming, and to the amazing music that has been shared today. So a couple of decades ago, when video was still kind of a new thing on the internet, there was a grainy black and white video that was making its way around the internet of a crow that was trying to get something it wanted out of a bottle. Maybe you've seen it. I don't remember what the object was that the crow was trying to get, but the crow had tried and failed repeatedly to retrieve it with its beak. And not for no reason, because scientists had specifically designed the bottle so the bird's head would not fit down into the bottom, and they were filming its futile efforts to retrieve it, which seems like kind of a mean trick. But the crow, in response, took a wire and carefully bent it into a hook shape and fished the object out of the bottle and took off with it. The whole video was maybe 50 seconds long, and it blew my mind when I saw it. This was a couple decades ago. Blew my mind. A bird blatantly using tools to get what it wanted. Tools. Take that, scientists. See, I went to school back in the day when learned books still said that humans were defined as the animal that used tools. And birds were still considered canonically unintelligent animals, right? Hence the insult, bird brain. And here was a bird, of all things, using tools, actually engineering tools, to problem solve. I was astounded, which just shows you how ignorant I was, because, of course, we now know that birds are wicked smart in general and do all kinds of amazing things. And crows do all kinds of amazing things. Crows can recognize faces. They can count to six or higher. And yes, they use tools to problem solve all the time. If you go on YouTube, you can find videos of Caledonia crows shaping and using hooks or dropping pebbles into jars of water to float objects up to the top where they can access them. You can see a 2-minute video of a crow tearing a piece of paper into just the right shape to activate a kind of vending machine. And I'm thinking back to my own experiences before debit card readers of trying to, like, smooth out that crumpled dollar bill to get it into the vending machine and how inept I was at that. Crows got me beat by a mile. So for a long time, scientists were skeptical that animals had even conscious experience, basic sentience, let alone self-awareness or intelligence. But increasingly, science is demonstrating that animals are much more intelligent and much more aware and much more complex than we had ever thought or supposed. Take the mirror test, for example. In 2005, Happy, an elephant who lives in the Bronx Zoo, became the first elephant to pass the mirror test. That means scientists painted a white X on Happy's forehead and then arranged for Happy to look into a mirror. When Happy saw the image of herself and saw the X on the animal in the mirror, she started touching the white X with her trunk, indicating that she understood that the elephant in the mirror was herself. And Happy thus joined a small, idiosyncratic, but growing list of animals who pass the mirror test, including chimpanzees, dolphins, and possibly two magpies. And what does this mean? If an animal recognizes itself, does that mean it possesses self-awareness? Does it experience its own inner states in some way analogous to human self-consciousness? We don't know. But let's talk about octopuses, the current reigning favorite intelligent animal, who's become famous for its complicated mind due to documentaries like My Octopus Teacher, right? In the book called Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness, author Peter Godfrey Smith explains that what makes octopuses so interesting to study is not their problem-solving ability or other measures of intelligence. They do okay, but the author admits octopuses are no Einsteins. What makes them interesting is their individual consciousness and their individual capriciousness that comes from their level of awareness. One student of octopuses said, when you work with fish, they have no idea they are inside a tank. But with octopuses, it's totally different. They know that they are inside this special place and that you are outside of it, and all of their behaviors are affected by their awareness of their own captivity. So octopuses mess with their experimenters. They recognize them and they play favorites. They squirt water down the backs of the ones they don't like. They blow out lights in the tanks by squirting jets of water at them. They plug up the outflow valves with their arms, causing the tanks to overflow and flood the lab. One octopus waited until it had its trainer's attention, and then it made a show of, like, deliberately throwing away uneaten a kind of food that it thought was particularly distasteful. Octopuses in general are masters at waiting until their captor is distracted and then busting out of confinement and crawling away on the floor. They've even been observed at play, jetting inedible pieces of plastic around the tank just for the fun of it, apparently. For much of history, animals were and are instruments. They're tools, investments, the food we eat, work partners. Even if there are laws around how animals can and can't be treated, and Unitarian Universalists have a lot of credit for those laws, by the way, animals are still understood as a category of property. But the more we understand the richness, the depth, and the complexity of animal awareness, the more surely we must rethink or reimagine that relationship. Problem solving, anticipating others, perceiving the self, playing favorites, playing around, these are sophisticated cognitive acts. And what does that mean for animal experience or animal awareness, right? What is it like to be a crow or a dolphin or an octopus? I mean, from the inside, what is the experience of their inner world? Do they have one? Should it matter? Whatever animal experience is like, it is certainly very different from human experience, right? And indeed, it is important to allow animals their own idiosyncratic animalness. They're not copies of us. Crows don't need to be like humans in order to be worthy of respect as a part of the interdependent web of life. A rat does not need to exclaim, "Oh, woe is me," for its suffering to count as suffering. A soliloquy is not a prerequisite for compassion. And so animals should not need to be like people for humans to treat them with, well, humanity. But when we do encounter intelligence and awareness and sensitivity in another being, surely it does touch something inside us that calls us to a different kind of relationship. Environmental scientist Robin Wall Kimmerer, who is also a member of the Potawatomi Nation, writes, "In the Western tradition, there's a recognized hierarchy of beings, with, of course, like human beings on top, right? The pinnacle of evolution, the darling of creation, and the plants at the bottom. But in the native ways of knowing, she says, humans are often referred to as the younger brothers of creation. We say that humans have the least experience with how to live, and thus the most to learn. And she says we must look to our teachers among the other species for guidance. Their wisdom is apparent in the way they live. They teach us by example, and they can do that because they have been on the earth far longer than we have been, and they have had more time to figure things out." So our older siblings of creation are not just found in the animal kingdom. And Kimmerer would say neither is wisdom and ways of knowing. Indeed, when we are willing to recognize that awareness, intelligence, responsiveness, even wisdom seems to be almost omnipresent in the natural world, even in the most unlikely of places, we humans as animals are naturally prejudiced to think of intelligence as something that happens in brains. We are prejudiced to think of intelligence as something that is accompanied by thought, even. But other animals exhibit intelligence in ways that we don't always see and appreciate a name for what it is. Other organisms, I should say. And sometimes we miss intelligence because it's happening at the wrong speed. We're used to intelligence happening at animal speed, the speed of running and ducking and darting out to secure prey. But a new generation of plant biologists argue that plants are also very intelligent, just at a different scale, a different time scale. In a 2013 article in The New Yorker called The Intelligent Plant, author Michael Pollan summarizes this view. It is only human arrogance and the fact that the lives of plants unfold in what amounts to a much slower dimension of time that keeps us from appreciating their intelligence and consequent success. Biologist Stephen Mancuso points out that we even use the metaphor of plants to indicate that which is senseless and non-responsive, right? We talk about being in a vegetative state. And yet plants are exquisitely aware and responsive to their surroundings. Plants have between 15 to 20 senses. corresponding to all of the human senses, and then many, many other ways of perceiving the world besides. They respond to sight, sound, and touch. We have all, I'm sure, seen footage of plants growing toward the light, right? We're familiar with that. But it's much more than that. It's much more than that. And now we know that plants can learn from and remember their experiences. A mimosa plant, the kind that curls its leaves at a touch, can learn that drops of water are harmless to it, that it doesn't need to curl up when it encounters water, and it can retain that knowledge for months. Plants can apprehend. A researcher recently found that if she played the recorded sound of a caterpillar chomping a leaf in the presence of a certain species of plant, it released chemicals to prime itself for the coming attack. In another experiment, a species of plant sent roots out toward the sound of water rushing through pipes, even though the pipes themselves were dry. Darwin thought that the roots of plants might be analogous to brains. He described plants as upside-down animals, with the brain below the surface and the body above. And meanwhile, in that above world, plants create a bewildering variety of chemicals, hundreds of chemicals, to respond to their environments. Plants use chemicals to attract friendly pollinators. They use chemicals to defend themselves. One species of plant, when attacked by a caterpillar, will release a chemical that summons another species of wasp to kill that caterpillar. Another species, when overgrazed by animals, will alter the chemical composition of its leaves to become disagreeable or even toxic to the grazing animal. It acts actively to defend itself. And plants do these things without brains or nervous systems. And the question, says Michael Pollan, is whether behaviors observed in plants that look very much like learning, memory, decision-making, and intelligence deserve to be called by those terms, or whether those words should be reserved exclusively for beings with brains. And to this list, we can add communication, cooperation, and kin care. Excuse me. Because we now know from the work of Suzanne Simard and others that trees communicate and cooperate with each other in quite complex ways. And Dr. Simard describes the process in a 2016 TED Talk called, straightforwardly enough, How Trees Talk to Each Other. And Darwin would not be at all surprised to learn that this communication happens underground. Because the root systems of trees, it turns out, are connected underground by networks of fungal threads called mycorrhiza, which arise from a symbiotic relationship between the tree and the fungus. The fungi get nutrients from the roots. The trees, in turn, use these fungal threads to send carbon, water, nutrients, and information bearing chemicals to distant trees. This allows trees to engage in reciprocal trade with one another, even across species. One species of tree will send its excess carbon to another tree in need, and then when that tree is the one with the excess carbon, it sends it back. The trees support each other. Simard discovered that this underground fungal network allows trees to engage in supportive parenting. So-called mother trees can actually recognize their own offspring in the forest and preferentially send those offspring nutrients, even chemical warning of impending insect incursions. And when a mother tree is injured, it sends its offspring information to help prepare them to survive. Samard showed that trees that are wired into these mother tree hubs have a better survival rate than trees that are isolated. And these connections are omnipresent below the forest floor. A signal tree will have its network of connections, and then each of those trees, of course, have their connections, and so ultimately the whole forest is wired together as a densely connected network of branches and hubs. And all along this network, there is this constant interchange of information and resources. Some have called it the wood wide web. And this connectedness allows the forest to be more resilient, more responsive, more adaptive, more intelligent than it otherwise would be. So again, we have to look past our human prejudices to focus on individual organisms and miss the behavior of the larger system. The individual trees are intelligent. The connected forest is wise. Researcher Dr. Ryan says her research in this area is motivated by her Aboriginal Tsimshian heritage and the guidance provided by her grandfather, her indigenous grandfather. Our worldview, she says, is that we are part of these ecosystems, that we are all connected together, We can't be separated from each other, and that collaboration is all a part of it. She concludes, the world is an entwined place. And the entwinement of the world is, of course, a fundamental Unitarian Universalist principle, right? Unitarian Universalism is, in many respects, a religion about relationship. And our seventh principle counsels us respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. And this seventh principle is the one that most Unitarian Universalists use to define our relationship to the natural world. But other religious traditions, including some Eastern traditions and some indigenous traditions, might challenge us to consider the world instead in the light of our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of each person. And the question is asked, what if we encountered all beings as having inherent worth and dignity? In a 2015 article in Yes magazine, Robin Wall Kimmerer argued that we need a new pronoun to fundamentally reorient ourselves in our relationship to nature. The article is appropriately called Nature Needs a New Pronoun. Kimmerer says that in her native language of Anishinaabe, which was erased from her family in the boarding school experience and which she is relearning, she said it is impossible to speak of a living tree as an it with that pronoun. The Anishinaabe and many other indigenous languages, she says, use the same word to address all living beings as we do our family, because they are our family. Kimmerer asks us to consider replacing the word it, when used in relation to beings in the natural world, with the pronoun ki, K-I, a much shortened form of the Anishinaabe word bimadizaki. The plural of this word, she suggests, would be kin. So imagine if embedded in our language itself was the idea that nature was our kin. How different would our world be? Would our oceans be dying? Would our forests be disappearing? Would the mass extinction of non-human species be an unrecognized, uncontested, and unchallenged reality of the modern world as it is today? How differently would we orient ourselves to the world if we saw it as kin? Each person, Kimmerer says, human or no, is bound to every other in a reciprocal relationship. Just as all beings have a duty to me, I have a duty to them. If an animal gives its life to feed me, I in turn bound to support its life. If I receive a stream's gift of pure water, I am responsible for returning a gift in kind. And an integral part of human's education, she says, is to know those duties and how to perform them. Just like we are counseled to honor our parents, to welcome the stranger, to treat guests with respect, to care for our neighbor, there is, in fact, a rich tradition in the West of mutual obligation, of respect, of concern for people, however imperfectly we live it out. So what if we extended this ethic of care to all of our kin, the kin of the natural world? Then we might say, in the words of the poet Mamadeh, you see, I am alive. I'm alive. I stand in good relation to the earth. I stand in good relation to the gods. I stand in good relation to all that is beautiful. You see, I am alive. I am alive. May it be so, and amen.